58B. In English, that would be 58B3. We're coming to the end of 58B. Just a little bit of a review to remind you where we were when we left off. We have been reading about Ona'at Devarim, which is hurting someone with words. We have seen that that involves intention as opposed to Ona'at Be'mekach U'Mimkar, the Ona'at that is relevant to sales and purchases. And we've made a slight shift by going to Ona'at Devarim and seeing the number of definitions that are connected with Ona'at Devarim. Among them, hurting somebody's feelings, deceiving them, Hamalbin et Pnei Chavero Barabim, somebody who embarrasses another in public. Okay? Let's just take, we could start with that on 58b3. Tamei Tana Kamei Derav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Right? The Tana talked before Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak. Kol Amalbin Pnei Chavero Barabim. Everybody who embarrasses his fellow in public, Ke'ilu Shofech Damim. It is as if he spills his blood. And remember the word Malbin Pnei, literally in Hebrew, I translated it as embarrassed, but it means literally to make white the face of. Right? So that's how it comes to mean to spill somebody's blood, that it's as if it's a murder because there's no blood left in their face. Okay? Ki'ilu shofech damim. Amar le shapir ka'amrat. He said, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says to him in response, it's smart what you say. Shapir, it makes sense. Wise. The Chazina Leda Azil Sum Kav'at Chivra, because I've seen it happen, and I saw that a person went from looking red to looking white.
Okay,
I'm not worried about that. Amale Abayel Rav Dimi. Abayel said to Rav Dimi, Bima Arava, in the West, B'mai Zahire, what are they worried about in the West, namely in the land of Israel? What is are they careful about? Amar le Rav Dimi said to him, and I explained to you that Rav Dimi was a Babylonian Amara who used to travel to the land of Israel. And then he would come back and they would ask him questions about what the practice was in the land of Israel. So he said, Ba'achvare ape. In the land of Israel, they're very concerned about embarrassing people. They don't want to do anything like that. The Amar Rav Chanina Hakol Yordin LeGeinom Chutz Mishlosha. And here you see a teaching from the land of Israel of Rabbi Chanina, and it is that everyone goes down to Gehenna except three people. Hakol Sal Kedatach. You mean to say everybody goes to Gehenna? Of course, that doesn't make any sense. Ela Ema, rather, let me say, Kol Yordin LeGeinom Olim Chutz Mishlosha. All those who go down to Gehenna also go up from Gehenna with the exception of three. So obviously, those three must be pretty bad. Right? Everybody has a time, everybody who has a time to burn in the fires of hell in order to get purified, eventually gets purified, with the exception of three, and they never have a chance to break out. And what are they? The Eluhain. Haba'al Eshet Ish. Somebody who has sexual relations with a married woman. Now, that we could understand. Hamalbin Pnei Chavero Barabim. Equated with that is somebody who embarrasses his fellow in public. Ve'amechane Shem Ra L'Chavero. And somebody who calls his fellow by a nickname. Now, that's a weird combination of three things if I ever saw it. First one I can understand is a major moral wrongdoing. If you're sleeping around with committing adultery, so this I understand. But to put adultery in the same boat as Malbin Pnei Chavero and as a Mechaneh Shem Ra LaChavero, calling somebody by a nickname, what's going on here? So then the Gemara says Mechaneh Hainu Malbin. Why do we have to separate the three of them out? Somebody who calls his fellow by a nickname, it's the same as if he's embarrassing himself. What's the difference between the two? The Gemara then answers, Af al gav de dashbe mishmei, even though a person is used to being called by that nickname. So it could be that a person is called by a nickname and isn't embarrassed by it. Right? Because you get used to something like that. Some types of embarrassment, you get used to it after a while. So what's the issue here? The issue is, when I called before, I used the term agadic hyperbole. This is agadic hyperbole. In the Agadah, when you have the teaching of moral lessons, frequently they are taught in a hyperbolic fashion. That is to say, there's exaggeration in the communication of how bad something is. So you take something that everybody knows, namely adultery. You don't have to be a great genius to know that the Torah forbids adultery. Come to Shul this week and you'll see it. The Ten Commandments. Right? Very basic stuff. So that's easy. So you use that also as a way of inculcating other things, some of which seem so simple that there's almost nothing wrong with them. The Mechanet Chavero, Mechaneh Shem Ra L'Chavero, somebody who calls his friend an embarrassing nickname, that's something that's probably common. And here, of course, the idea is that you should be as sensitive to the common daily types of embarrassment that we cause each other as to the things that stand out and shout from the rooftops. And even the way this language is used, hadash be bishmei, dash, a mitzvah, dash is sometimes used in case of those mitzvot that are so simple that they're just kicked around. Dash means to kick around. You kick around a mitzvah. And there's nothing outstanding about it at all. And so you think it's something of such little significance. You think it's little significance? The Torah says you're not allowed to hurt somebody with your words. Therefore, don't think that it's of little significance. It's a heavy and a weighty thing, even if it's not intuitively so. But that's the way the Agadah communicates ideas. Questions here? Okay, now the Gemara, once having said this, we'll go on to elaborate. Amar Rabba Babar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Noach lo li adam shiyavo al sfeik eshet ish. It is better for a person, God forbid, to get involved in a situation which might be a case of adultery than to embarrass his friend in public. And that, of course, is completely absurd. I can't imagine the logic behind that at all. But of course, that's exactly the way the Gemara will say it, because that's what it wants you to think. It's so absurd to think this that you have to think twice. You have to think twice, and it has to make an impression upon you that this thing that didn't seem like it was important really is important. And the nature of the proof, I will go through this proof and read it to you as I understand it. If you really want to see something absurd, read the English commentary on it. Because the English commentary is much worse than the text is. But it is what it is. Okay. Midrasha Rava. Rava interpreted a verse in the following way. So he interprets the verse in the book of Psalms, 35th Psalm. Uvisal'i samchu v'nesfu kar'u v'lo damu. When I limped, samchu v'nesfu, my enemies rejoiced and gathered together. Kar'u v'lo damu. They tore at me, v'lo damu, and would not be silenced. Okay? Now we have the interpretation that will follow. And Agadah follows this. Amar David Difnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. King David says before the Holy One, Blessed be He. Now, King David, you have to remember, was no tzaddik. He was a good poet, but not a tzaddik. So, and in the subsequent literature, some of the literature will be willing to say that. And some of the literature will not be willing to say that. Why? Because it was King David. And how could King David not be a tzaddik? It's very logical. Right? But if you read the story of King David in the book of 2 Samuel and you follow what goes on, this guy was worse than a philanderer. He fell in love with Bathsheba and effectively had her husband killed. And that's not to be recommended. It's not a good idea. Okay? But this is what makes the Bible interesting. You know, the Bible is the kind of book that draws you in. It has real live heroes in it, and they're, as is the case in the Bible, they're flawed, very flawed human beings. And naturally, what makes it really interesting is that you have this flawed human being who has a heart and who's a great poet and who eventually also is penitent. He's a penitent soul about his own flaws, and he's able to write about those things. So that makes him, you know, somebody that is in fact an extraordinary human being. But it's not simplistic. It's profound. It's subtle, and it's difficult. So here is David, and he writes in the Psalms, "Ubetzali samchu." Very frequently, you read in the Psalms the pain that David has from his enemies. And he has a variety of enemies. He has enemies in the court. He has enemies in his own family. He has enemies who are his foes, the foes to the Israelites, the Philistines are his enemies. They have a variety of enemies here, and it's not an infrequent lament that David enters into when he laments about his enemies and how terrible they are. Uvetzali, litzloa, probably means to limp, to limp. But you have to remember also that tzela in Hebrew means a rib. Okay? And do you remember who was created from a rib? Okay. Eve was created from Adam's rib. So, ubitzal'i has a double entendre to it. It means when I limped, and the same word also means on account of my wife. Now that's the richness of Hebrew. And Hebrew is kind of amazing that you could actually hear both those things when you read that one word.
Which wife out of the thousand?
This wife would be Bathsheba. This is Bathsheba, because she was the one with whom he consorted when he had sent her husband away. Okay? The husband eventually is killed on the front lines. And that's all part of the plan here. It's all part of the plan. So David's enemies, now his enemies are also harping on his moral flaws, because he is a flawed human being. And if you have enemies, they pick that up very quickly. Even if you be a penitent human being, they don't let you forget your flaws, and particularly when they're really major flaws, like this. Uvetzal'i, therefore, is when I limped, or on account of this wife of Bathsheba, samchu, they rejoiced. They rejoiced when I was punished as a result of all of this. Vinesvu, and they gathered together, and I think the force of kar'u is they rent their clothes. In other words, in a mocking form. They mocked me. They rent as if they really cared about my hurt, but they cared only to hurt me more, and they did that in such an awful way by acting as if they cared about me. All right, so it's really quite something here. Nesvu karu velo damu. Now lo damu probably means, as it says here, that they weren't silenced. They just kept up with this. They kept taunting me. That's David complaining here. Although damu, it comes from the word dam.
Blood.
And we see malbim penecha vero is somebody who knocks the blood out of his friends. Okay, so here there's an overtone of that too. Amar David lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, David said before the Holy One, blessed be He, Ribono Shel Olam, Lord of the world, Galui v'yadua lifanecha, it is well known before you, She'im ayu mekar'in b'saro, b'sari, that if my enemies were to tear my flesh, lo haya dami shotet la'aretz, oh, my blood would not have spilled to the ground, because they took all my blood out of me. Right? They were malbinei penei panai. They embarrassed me so, they tried to really upset me so, that they took all the blood from me. Now that's, realize what he had done. He was an adulterer. Or he was perhaps an adulterer. I mean, he was, in theory, the rabbis concoct a way in which maybe he wasn't as much of an adulterer as he seemed like an adulterer, but he was an adulterer. So here you have a case where the enemies have taken out his blood, namely, they were malbinei panim. They made his face white. They embarrassed him. And he, and his own, on his own side, he was an adulterer. And that's what we started off with. Noach lo le'adam. It's better that a person possibly commits some state of adultery. God, I don't even want to say it too many times. It's such a terrible thing to say. Al sefek eshet ish, va'al yabim penecha v'rabi rabim. Rather than, God forbid, the terrible thing which his enemies eventually did, which he was complaining about, which was taking all the blood out of him.
Yeah, but he did it because what he did before. That was the reaction.
Absolutely. But we're reading now from David's point of view. From David's point of view, we see how terrible this is.
The point of stuff.
Okay? And again, I understand this to be entirely hyperbolic. I use that term hyperbole, because I do not think that this can at all be understood in any logical or intuitive fashion. I think that this is simply a way of inculcating a moral value which is not exactly intuitive. And is certainly not at the level of these other things that we understand to be major moral values. What the Gemara does is simply turn things a little bit upside down in order to make a point. Barry, you're going to say?
I was just wondering if they made the kind of distinction that we make between public figures and private figures. In other words, people who have political leadership positions, whether it's more fair game to criticize them than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. I suspect that's true, yes. Because that is the place of the king. One of the places served by the kings in the Bible is in fact that they are fair game. And that's one of the reasons I'm convinced that they're so interesting. Because the moral flaws or the religious flaws are played out on these kings. And that's the way the Bible teaches you and me who read it, that this is a terrible thing that these people have done. Right? It doesn't tell us what Joe Schmo does so much. Yeah, it does. Every once in a while it tells us that. When it tells us what the kings do, that makes a point.
So, then this whole issue of shaming or comments about people, are there then two standards for that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because in our own society, the things people would say about a president who they don't like politically often transgress way beyond what you would ever accept if they were saying it about a colleague in business or something. But because it's in this political context and the notion of the public figure, mm-hmm, that we allow a lot more discretion.
I think it's true.
Comments.
I think it's true. We do allow that, and I think that's true. You see that in the Bible too. I think it's quite true.
I think we, in other chapter of the Talmud, we talked, there was mentioning about when Moses was going in front of the people, they said, don't look at his thighs and in his neck.
Right.
Is this something to that degree of Malbin Nechadu Oberlovin?
That I don't remember. I'm not sure. I just don't remember it. Whether that was in any way a reference to this concept.
Because of the money they collect and look what they have with the money, they eat well. Mm-hmm. Maybe that was
right.
At that time, the connotation of that story.
Could be. It's a nice thought. Okay, v'lo od, and it goes on. He's not finished yet. Lo od, ela afilu b'sha'a sha'oskin bin negaim v'ohalot. And here again, this is just classic rabbinics. Even when they are engaged, namely David's enemies are engaged, in the study of negaim v'ohalot, the laws of negaim and the laws of tents, omrim li, they say to me, David, haba al eshet ish mitato bameh. David, who has sexual relations with a married woman, what is his fate to be? His fate is death, bameh. In what form of execution is he supposed to die? V'ni omer lahem, and I say to them, mitato b'chenek. His execution shall be by strangulation. V'yesh lo chelak la'olam haba, but he will have a place in the world to come. Aval, but hamalbin et pnei chaveiro b'rabim, but the person who embarrasses his fellow, ein lo chelak la'olam haba, he has no place in the world to come. Now, let's just take this the second part. Here, in classic instance of rabbinic hyperbole, David is seen as reflecting on what goes on in the house of study. It being assumed, of course, that all of his enemies are sitting in the yeshiva and studying Talmud. That's an obvious assumption, you know, and certainly that's what they were doing. And not only are they studying Talmud, but they are studying the most obscure pieces of the Talmud, which is what we are talking about. Nigaim are the laws of Tzara'at, the laws of leprosy. Now, the rabbis are smart enough, and their humor is such, that they know that that is called the abstruse of the abstruse, to study the laws of leprosy, which nobody understands. But that has nothing to do with the fact that it's something that everybody has to study. Because we don't really have to know it. What the practical side is. It's not all that practical. They didn't really deal with these things all that much. But they had to study them because it was a major issue in the Torah. It's a major issue in the Torah, and so therefore it's a major issue to study. It's highly abstruse arguments in the rabbinic literature. Very difficult to understand. Anyway, we have from time to time seen the laws of Negaim. Something is mitameh, something else. Something causes, certain types of things can cause the spread of tum'ah, ritual impurity, as a result of contact. Other things can cause it only as a result of contact with things that are moist. Other things are contacted when they are sat upon. You can have six pillows, and somebody can sit on the top pillow, and the sixth pillow on the bottom becomes tameh. Now, if that isn't abstruse stuff, you don't know it's abstruse. No way. That's the simple stuff. That's kashrut. Kashrut is called easy. The laws of tumah are called complex. And similarly, olot. Olot is the laws of tents, and that has nothing to do with tents, really. That's the laws of tents have to do with the spreading of the tumah of death. If there is a dead body, and that dead body is in the tent, and you walk into the tent, then you become tamei also. And that can spread. If you are in contiguous spaces that are covered spaces, let's say in a building, in this building, and you had, God forbid, a corpse in this building, it would be prohibited for a Kohen to walk into this building. You know that there's a corpse here. Okay? Those are the laws of Ohalot. Those are the laws of tents. So that is shorthand now for all of the complexities of the laws of Tumah as they relate to death. And these can be so complex that for a while ago, Elal had an interesting problem. Had a problem of the tuma, because there was no tent on top of the tuma in a cemetery in Tel Aviv. The tuma goes straight up to the sky. Right? And then the question is, when the plane crosses the cemetery, is that a prohibited entry of the Kohen into the cemetery? Because the airspace of a cemetery is a cemetery. You had a story?
Better one. A friend of mine lost his father here in the States, and he decided to take him to Israel to be buried. Took El Al, and my friend was a sentinel. Knew there was a Kohen on the plane. He happened to mention, you know, my deceased father is So what do you do when this? You know, there are
Well, what you have to do, I mean, just the simple way that you have to deal with it,
public disclosure. I mean, what's the answer?
Is that you have to have an ohel over. You have to create partitions in ways that you don't have contiguous spaces, but you have separate spaces, and you have to have the proper partition. Then, so the question is,
did they correct?
And Elal should be expert in this. But they had to become expert because of these issues. This is called abstruse stuff. This is the kind of stuff that King David's enemies, of course, were talking about. Right? Can you imagine that?
What they knew about the planes coming over?
Sure, of course. That's what they were dealing with every day. Yes.
I don't mean to digress, but what do they do in the case of war where
there are
dead bodies all over the place?
Oh, well, if you can't avoid it, that's one thing. The question is if you can't avoid it. If you can avoid it, then you have to avoid it. Okay? So here you get the picture. King David is complaining now about all of the enemies, and what do? They, even when they are sitting and studying these abstruse categories of rabbinic law, what do? They confront him and they embarrass him. David. They say to him, David, David. Okay? They talk to him. And they ask him a question of law, because after all, he's the king. And so he is assumed to be the Rosh Hashiva. He knows more than anybody else. So I said to him, in a case where there is a man who sleeps with another man's wife, what is the penalty? Then the Omer, and David says, as I said, because of course I know the law, I said to them, that man dies bechenek, with strangulation. All right? That's a very serious offense. Very serious offense, adultery. And of course they asked, in the middle of everything, that's what they think about. Why do they think about that? Because they want to embarrass me. That's why they want to do it. Okay? But David, of course, is the king, so he's not totally nonplussed by this. He has an answer for them. He says, but you're worse than I am. That's effectively his answer. You're worse than I am. Why? Because Amalbina Penecha Berabba Rabim, he who embarrasses his friend in public is worse, because even the adulterer can have redemption in the world to come. But we have in the rabbinic tradition that the person who creates embarrassment, he can never be redeemed. He has no place in the world to come. Now, why that? Because in fact, the adulterer has no penalty by a human court. The adulterer has penalty by a human court. There is a penalty for adultery, and the human court can adjudicate a case and can deliver it as a capital offense. It's a capital offense according to the Torah, and the court is given that right. Now, if a person embarrasses somebody else, what do you think the court can do about it? Nothing. Of course, nothing. The laws of Ona'ah, in fact, these laws of Ona'ah Tvarim, there's very little you can do about them. I mean, you can use a certain amount of social pressure. But of course, the way the rabbis do it is that they say, but it's so terrible to come to the world to come, you're not going to get anything. In other words, that is the moral force of their argument. They create a moral argument in order to define a category which is a part of normal human abuse, which is the persecution of other people with our tongues. You can understand, therefore, in later times, in our own day, we talk of Lashon Hara. I mean, Lashon Hara is also discussed in this literature. Lashon Hara is a variety of possible things. It's not slander. That's something else. That's Motzi Shemra. But Lashon Hara is speaking ill of someone else. So in our religious tradition, this becomes a whole area of moral study. And there have been movements. The Muslim movement, for example, in the 19th and the 20th centuries, was a movement that was dedicated centrally to trying to have control over a person's tongue and to the evil that's done regularly by the tongue. And again, I think that all of this is a way of making those points. Questions? Yes.
We know that God punished David but not allowing him to build the temple. But his son.
Well, he had other punishments too.
But not by the public.
He had worse punishments, which was from his own family. Remember, his son rebels against him. His son tries to uproot him from his kingship. His son is eventually killed as a result of that. You don't want his problems. I mean, you know, you don't want his pleasures and you don't want his problems too. So he gets in his own, the way the Bible does it. The Bible sort of works things out. Everybody who deserves things usually always gets them. So no, if not in the same chapter, a few chapters later.
So I have a geography question. Yad Avshalom in Jerusalem.
Yad Avshalom.
Shalom in Jerusalem. And the proximity to Gay Ben Hinnom.
Mm-hmm.
Any connection?
Probably. I don't know for sure, but probably the answer is yes. Yeah. Okay, we go on.
They even brought a snake in.
Okay. Amar Mazutra Bartuvia Amar Rav. Now here we're getting a little bit later. Remember we were dealing with Rabbi Hanina, who is earlier. Now we're going to a Rav, who is an Amora. The Amrila Amar Rav Chana, Rav Chana Bar Bizna Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida. Long line of tradition. Ba'amrei la'ma Rabbi Yochanan mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. It's an interesting line of tradition. It goes from the Babylonian Amoraim to the Palestinian Amoraim, right back to the rabbinic period, to the Tanaim, because finally the last one is Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai lived in the second century and was a Tana of the land of Israel. So in other words, this is an effort to really couch this as a baraita. Noach lo li adam shiapil atzmo lekivshana esh. It is better for a man to throw himself into the fiery furnace, va'al yabim penecha ve'roba rabim, rather than to embarrass his fellow in public. Mitamar, and the proof goes from the story of Tamar in the Bible. Dichtiv, Tamar then becomes the example of the tzadeket, of the righteous woman. Remember the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Yehuda and Tamar is the story in the Bible where Yehuda has a son who's married to Tamar. Son dies, and there are other sons, and one is Onan, and spills the seed on the ground, and then there's yet a last son whom he's supposed to marry off to Tamar, and he forgets about the whole thing. Eventually, she confronts him. She disguises herself as a prostitute. And he then goes in to see her. And then eventually, she disappears. And she becomes pregnant from him. And of course, he had wronged her in the first place. And she, when asked, you know, who is the father of this child, she doesn't say. She says instead, the one who owns these things. Because she took from him a certain gift that he gave to her. But she won't say who it was. So she, of course, didn't want to embarrass him in public. That's the whole idea here. So here, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai uses Tamar as the example of somebody who has every reason to embarrass somebody, but of course she refrained from doing that, and she becomes therefore the example of the tzedakah.
And the kid suffers.
Okay. He had no choice in the matter. Okay.
I said, unlike the woman who put the big billboards in Times Square.
What was that? I don't know what that is.
Who did she have a relationship with?
It's
a public figure in Washington. Had an affair with someone. Married, had an affair, and he denied it. So the woman took out huge billboards with pictures showing her together with him. In Times Square and other cities in the country.
All right. All right. None of this should be taken to condone adultery. I should underline the obvious. I'm simply saying that I think that the literary methodology used is to take what is so strong, so obvious, and so taboo as adultery, and to use that as a handle for teaching something that's not quite so obvious. Okay, that's, I think, what's going on here. Yes.
I seem to recall, I don't recall the details, but in past studies in Talmud, we came across some fairly vicious stuff going on among the rabbis, where they're criticizing each other, and if my recollection is correct, that doesn't seem...
That's a good point. It's a good point. What are the limits? What is embarrassment? What is not? And may there be certain situations where it's permissible. If a person has done wrong, you're a corporation president, and somebody has stolen money, you shouldn't talk about it. You're not, to the contrary, you should talk about it. There are a variety of circumstances. You're bringing up children. And do you mean to say you shouldn't talk about people even by name to your children? It may be very important for the moral inculcation of certain values to speak very directly to your children so they will, number one, know how to protect themselves, and number two, learn what's right and what's wrong. I think that what you are dealing with here is, I go back to the notion of ona'at avarim, which I tried to contrast to the other form of ona'ah, the first one that we had, which was in business dealings. I think that what is essential here is the notion that what you are saying or doing is designed, has the clear intention of making a person feel bad. Okay? What you are doing is being done to make them feel bad. And I think that's very different than where, in fact, you may have recourse, and it may be necessary in certain circumstances, and I'm not saying that all circumstances, but it may be certain circumstances where, in fact, it makes sense to talk about other people, even in their presence. I can well imagine certain discussions where this has to take place and where people will express their anger at somebody else's actions and where it will be meant sincerely and there will be a reasonable purpose for it, purpose not being in order to make a person feel bad. So I think that you have to keep that in mind here, that there are circumstances where it may be morally appropriate to engage in certain types of discussions, even in a public forum. But I think that what we are dealing with here is where you are clearly have the intent of what you are saying is to make a person feel bad. Okay? Yes?
I'm going to make a good case, but there seems to be a distinction here in terms of not doing this because you don't want to make somebody feel bad, or not doing it because you're going to steal somebody's reputation. And so when we started talking about it, I maybe erroneously made the assumption that we were talking about these statements you could make about people and things like that as stealing their reputation and things like that. And that sort of makes sense because you could steal money, stealing reputation and property and things like that. And I thought that that was the connection. But what you're really saying here is something different. You're saying that the emphasis here or the force of it is to not do something because you're going to embarrass somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure Madoff was embarrassed, okay, in terms of what, you know, happened, okay, but that wasn't, you know, who cares if you're embarrassed?
Exactly.
So
I'm saying that.
Which is the case?
I think it's both those things. And I think that, again, an attack on Madoff, you're not doing any of this to embarrass him. That's irrelevant. You're doing this in order to set a wrong right. And you know, he will be dealt with by the law. The purpose is not to besmirch him. You know, he did that. And I rather think that a moral purpose is served by stating it and stating it publicly.
So the truth, then, okay, if you state the truth,
mm-hmm.
you're not in violation of this, even though you're hurting somebody's feelings.
That's correct. As far as this goes, as far as I'm not saying that it's always okay to do that, because there are other issues, such as the question of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is a prohibition on stating certain truths. But there again, I think there we have to weigh those circumstances where it may be necessary. If I know that somebody is I know private information about somebody. Private information to begin with. It's true information. It's not false information. It's true information. I know that somebody had a wife once before. Okay? I'm not allowed to talk about that. I can't talk about it. Because it's private information, and private information that I have, I cannot share in public. Because of the law of Lo Telech Rachel B'Amecha, you're not allowed to go and peddle the information about someone to someone else. Because that cheapens their reputation. That cheapens their reputation. Now, that having been said, I can also imagine circumstances where I have to do that. I have to talk about it. Let's say I know that information and this guy wants to marry somebody. And I know that he's already married to another woman. Right? There is a conflict of two obligations there. And it's very clear which one takes precedence. I have to protect the woman who could be hurt by this. Right? So just to say something doesn't mean there aren't limitations to it. Okay? But there are different issues that have to be weighed. Yes, ma'am.
Being that our elected officials, the king at the time, the rabbis, to a certain extent serve at the will of the people, isn't this really an early form of public relations or self-serving to the extent that to keep those in authority out of beyond the touch, beyond the reach of the rest of us, that to an extent of trying to give them an elevation of.
There's some truth to that. I think that there is some truth to that. And you'll see even a little more of it. But I think that's also an issue that we have to deal with. To what extent should we respect the privacy of public officials, or do they have no privacy? That's an issue that I think we continue to deal with. There may be areas where we say that it would be appropriate for the public good to compromise that privacy. And yet, conceivably, there are areas where we should not be compromising our privacy, or else we will have no public officials, or at least no good public officials. And it also is debasing to the community at a certain point to do that, to invade everyone's privacy.
I was thinking, like you, I think obviously it's wrong to commit adultery or a serious error, but maybe there is some element of truth in the worseness, or one way of looking at it, of pointing fingers, because that involves hubris, that when one human and not God puts himself on another, that implies to me a different sort of moral error, which may be just as great, depending on the circumstances.
Maybe true. That's a good point. Maybe true.
And what about the tradition, and maybe going to get to it, of you're not supposed to say anything bad about a person who's passed away? Do they get
into we did that before. That's not in here, I don't think.
But it's related in a way.
Correct.
But you're no longer embarrassing them, so how do they equate that?
Well, we have this notion that honoring a parent in particular continues beyond the grave. There's no time limit to it. And the opposite of that is the embarrassment side of it, that you have to be concerned with people even beyond the normal time limits. So I think that that's true. And I think that that is another way of extending the considerations here into a larger time frame.
It's a question of reputation.
Yeah. Because reputation goes beyond life. Exactly.
Let me get back to something you said earlier, which is that it's far from obvious that speaking bad or humiliating someone in public is a much more serious crime than committing adultery with a married woman. In the case they've chosen to discuss, which is the behavior of King David with Bathsheba, it's a case of a man who committed adultery with a married woman, and he's then humiliated publicly by his critics. So this is really not obvious, because he committed a serious crime and was not punished for it. Not in his life.
Right. Okay.
Well, he wasn't punished by the punishment, which is how should he die by having come by strangulation. Right. That he was not punished by. And his critics are students of the law. Issue students who are. So I'm thinking the whole thing is a setup, as you say, just to make you think about something you never would have thought about before, because here it's really not obvious. Mm-hmm. You could easily feel these Shiva students who are not only studying the law, they're so serious that they are even studying things which maybe other students would have. So, I read it. I don't remember it. I don't think it's intended to draw a legal parallel. I'm agreeing with what you said. It seems like it's trying to provoke you to think about your own behavior and throw up to you something that's so problematical that it forces you to think about it.
You make me think that maybe we should see this even more localized, that what the rabbis are doing are in fact reflecting the kinds of moral abuses that they saw going on every day in the yeshiva. These are the kinds of things people would sit around, they would study, and they would spend their spare time eating each other up, you know, which is not an unusual way for human beings to spend their time. And maybe part of the force of using such an example is to bring it all home. It's us guys, you know, we're the ones, and we got to remember these things too, you know, that we shouldn't think that because we're really lofty students who are studying the Torah and who are involved in all these intricate things, that we're free from the law. We have, you know, partly because we are who we are, there are greater obligations on us. Nice.
About the dead person can't defend themselves.
That's true. That's
so
additional thing. That's correct.
They're uniquely vulnerable.
That's right.
Position.
That's right.
But the other point I would make is this discussion reminds me of the teaching, the psychology teaching with children, that if a child does something that you don't think is right, you don't tell the child you're a bad child. Focus on the behavior. Mm-hmm. The behavior is unacceptable, not the child.
Right.
And make that distinction very clear. And I think here, the whole ability to extract a moral relevance, they're trying to move it away from the person onto the behavior, I think. And I think that is the appropriate way to do it, to try, because the minute it becomes the person, it actually in many ways loses the moral force, because then it seems like it's just a bad person rather than a behavior that we need to eliminate from all people, as opposed to just having a single morally corrupt individual.
And now you help me understand why Jews gave birth to psychiatry. It's a basic way of looking at the world, which probably you're right. This is the way we look at the world. That's the way we see human behavior. Very good. Okay, we go on. Amar Rav Chinana b'Rei d'Rav Idi, Mai d'chtiv lo tonu ish et amito. Now remember that there were two biblical verses that prohibited ona'ah. One of them mentioned buying and selling. That one is here, Leviticus 25, 14, thank you. V'chitim karumim karla amitecha, when you make a sale to your amit, to your fellow, o kanomi an amitecha, or you make a purchase from the hand of your amit, same word again, amit, your fellow, Al tonu ish et achiv. You shall not wrong one person his brother. Now there's a little bit of an odd stylistic variant here. Two times we have the word amit used, and then the third time where it says lo tonu, you shall not wrong, they should have said amitcha or something like that. But they don't do that. And they switch it to achiv, to the word brother.
Make a stronger point.
Right. Now, the next time it appears in verse 17, it says, Velo tonu ish et amito. You shall not wrong a person amito, his fellow. All right, so here after the word tonu, you get the word amit. So the second one we said was ona'at devarim, wronging a person with words. The first one was wronging a person in the marketplace. Okay? In the second one, we had a direct juxtaposition of the word amit next to the command that you're not allowed to do it. Okay? That's my background. Look at the Gemara. Gemara then says, V'lo tonu ish et amitoho. This is referring to ona atevarim, the second time this appears, where it says, you shall not wrong ish et amito, a person, his amit, his fellow. So then it says, and the question is, why do we have the word amit connected to lotonu, you shall not wrong them with words? Why is the word amit connected with that, and not with the other one? Right? And it has a theory. Am she'idcha b'Torah u'b'mitzvot al tonehu. A person who is with you in Torah and mitzvot, you shall not wrong him. Now, let's see what this means. Amit is taken to be imcha. Imcha, the word amit and imcha are right next door to each other. So it means with you. So the rabbinic comment is, with you in Torah and mitzvot. Now, there are a variety of possible ways to understand that. It could be that this is referring to Jews as opposed to Gentiles. Right? When you're dealing with the inner group, you have to be more careful than when you're dealing with the outer group.
Like a shanda for the neighbors.
It's a shanda for the... Maybe. Okay. Or it could be, the way the English comment on this is, that this is something that is perhaps limited to those who are with you in Torah mitzvot, that is to say people who are the religious people as opposed to the not religious people. A terrible interpretation. That's in the odd scroll here. Sort of an odd scroll type of interpretation. It kind of reminds me why I have difficulty with it. On the other hand, let's go back to what Robert said before. It could be that this is referring back to the yeshiva. And in fact, what the emphasis we're getting here is on the community of people who are studying the Torah and on the way they are abusing each other. And that within the inner circle, they in fact are doing this all the time. And therefore we have to point out that even in the inner circle, you guys got to watch out. Okay?
I would think that the best English translation is the word buddy.
Buddy. Okay. That's good. Now, lest you think that the law of Ona'ah, this came up earlier on, I remember some of you were interested in this, question of whether this applies to Gentiles or Jews. And in general, the laws of Ona'ah, whether it is permissible to deceive a Gentile. Because you might conceivably understand this and what we've just read to be allowing that. So I wanted to show you what the law was in this case. Let me read to you. This is from the Tor Shulchan Aruch in Choshen Mishpat. And it's very interesting to see what they say here. Yizaher Adam Milechanot Shem Lechavero. A person should be careful not to call his friend by a nickname, Kedei Levayesho, with the intent of embarrassing him. Okay? Nothing wrong with a nickname. But here the Shulchan Aruch really makes it better to make it clearer that it's the intent. The question is a question of intent. Afilu shehu ragil bioto kinui. Even if a person becomes used to that kind of a nickname. Kevan shekavanato levayesho. Since it is his intention to embarrass him. That's a conclusion I think that we came to. Asur l'ramot b'nei adam. It is prohibited to deceive. Here the key word in the Shulchan Aruch is b'nei adam. You know what? B'nei adam means people. And b'nei adam is used only where this applies to non-Jews as well as Jews. So that now applies to everybody. It is prohibited to deceive human beings, b'mekach u'mimkach, in your business dealings, oli gnov da'atam, or to deceive them, kogon in yesh mum b'mikcho, such as if there is something wrong with what you're selling them, sarich lehodio l'lokeh, you have to make that clear to the buyer. Now that applies, therefore, to Gentiles as well as Jews. There's no difference between Gentiles and Jews. So you have to, if you have a damaged piece of merchandise, you have to reveal to the potential buyer the damage in the merchandise. The af im hu akum, even if this person is an idolater, and the Jewish tradition does not suffer idolaters gently. Lo yimkor lo basar nevela, you should not sell that idolater nevela, that is to say trefa food, becheska shehi shchuta, with the assumption that it's kosher. Okay, so kosher food is usually more expensive than trefa food. So you have a nevela, and the Gentile knows, the Gentile wants to eat kosher food. You wouldn't eat this food because this food has not been slaughtered properly, so you wouldn't eat it. But you're going to tell the goy that? The goy figures that whatever you have for sale is kosher. And you're going to charge the higher price which you charge for the kosher food. Are you allowed to do that to the Gentile? You're not allowed to do that to the Gentile. The basic point here is, and I'll read to you the Shulchan Aruch, lest you think otherwise, Shulchan Aruch makes it quite clear, I think, that all of this applies to Bnei Adam, to Basar Adam, to all people. Okay?
Is that commentary on what we're studying?
Yes, this actually is, if you look at what we have, this piece that we just read now, in the text itself, you will see reference made to what I have just read to you.
It doesn't seem to me that we've discussed deception.
Oh yes, that was what we was before.
Oh,
that was right before this.
Was,
Oh, now also included deception. That was where you go into a store and you make it seem as if you're going to buy something, you're not intending to buy something. All of that is in the realm of deception. Okay? And what we are going to get to, in fact, faulty merchandise, is the next Mishnah. So that's all, we're sort of moving between these issues. The next Mishnah is going to deal with truth in advertising. Issues of truth in advertising. If you have strawberries, and they put the spoiled strawberries underneath the good strawberries, is that permissible?
I've seen that. The green is where they're gone.
Okay, so that's the next Mishnah.
In terms of...
Not true.
In terms of the procedure, how this would work out with a Gentile, I can understand if you're talking, two Jewish people are in a dispute, it's resolved by a Beth Din. But if you're talking here about some relationship, problem, issue with a non-Jew, I don't... I would not.
Very good point. That's a good point.
I don't think a non-Jew can go in, or can a non-Jew go into a Beth Din and seek resolution of an issue.
It's possible. It's possible. But I think that your basic point is important to understand here, because I think, once again, you're not dealing with issues that would normally be adjudicated in a Beit Din. Rather, you're dealing with a moral context and with the effort now to advertise and to urge certain types of behavior, which in nearly all cases will never make it to the Beit Din.
But for the money on it, would that be in the Beit Din?
Oh, I see. Yes, no. That is true. You are right. As far as that goes, okay, that would go to court, and the Gentile would also have access to that court. Yes. In that case, because the court would have jurisdiction also for the Gentile, because it's a law that affects the Gentile. So he's no gebet davar. He's affected by it, and therefore the law has some jurisdiction for him. Good. Okay, we go on. Now, you're going to see the series of transitions that we make in the Gemara here. And this is a fascinating transition. Amar Rav. Rav said, Rav is the first generation of Amoraim. He's a cross generation. He's considered the last of the Tanaim and the first of the Babylonian Amoraim. Le'olam yehe adam zehir ba'ona at ishto. Here, when I'm talking about moral teaching, here you have a perfect example of the way in which an idea is extended into the home sphere, and specifically to the rabbinical students, where the Gemara says, a person should always be very careful about ona at ishto, making his wife feel bad. Interesting extension of it. Okay? Alright? Shemitoch Shedimata. What am I missing? What? Shemitoch Shedimata Mitsuya. Because her tear is easy to elicit. Ona ata krova. It is easy to hurt her feelings. Right? In other words, because a woman, one's wife, may feel emotional, may have her emotions stirred very easily, you have to be especially careful. She doesn't necessarily have a thick skin.
That world is gone.
No, it hasn't gone. Maybe gone here and there, but it's not gone.
Not gone.
No. The issue here is the relation between husband and wife, and the obligation here on the husband to be particularly careful about his wife's feelings, and particularly in the context, I think, of the students who are studying this. Assume a male group of students who are studying. Here, the rabbis are trying to inculcate in the boys and the men. treating their wife with proper respect. And that's not to be taken for granted. I think it's just a nice shift, a shift from the general issue to, in fact, the issue of one's wife. Amar Rabbi Elazar, miyom shenechra bet hamikdash, and this is then more generalized in another direction, from the day that the temple was destroyed, ninalu sharet tefila. It's a very fascinating idea. The gates of prayer have been closed. Namely, the temple offered a way of getting close to God, that once the temple is destroyed, we no longer have that. We no longer have, access to God. And even prayer itself has tremendous limitations, with the following exception. Well, no, it says first, Shenemar, Gam ki ezakta ashavea satam tefilati. Even when I cried out, my prayer has been stopped up. Okay? It's a very moving statement about the destruction of the temple and the impediment it places to a religious human being. The afal pi shesharei tefila ninalu. Even though the gates of prayer have been locked, Sha'arei dema'ot lo ninalu, the gates of tears have never been locked. They have never been locked. Shenemar, as it says, Shim'a tefilati Hashem shavati ha'azina. Listen to my prayer, O Lord. Pay attention. Hear it. El dimati al techrash. You will not be silent to my tears. It's a very basic idea in Judaism that while there may be limits to prayer, there is no limit to tears. And when one weeps, the weeping has a direct access to God's presence. Okay? And that comes then from the wife. The emotional sensitivity of a wife being concerned about making her feel bad then leads to the discussion about God and really what the root is to God, which is ultimately a root through tears.
Is this connected to Tachanun?
It will be immediately become connected to Tachanun. You're going to see it connected to Tachanun. All right, you're going to see a connection to Tachanun.
Right.
Yes.
That remark that was made about attitude or treating your wife actually applies to anybody who's close to you.
I would say yes, but especially your wife. Wives are closer to you in a certain way than anybody
else. Let's say brother or sister.
A wife is different from all of them. Because ultimately, a brother and a sister are your brother and sister forever. The wife is the only one that you have a committed relationship to that in fact could end. You can never end being a brother or a sister. It's just not possible. Never end being a child. But the wife is a relationship that has that degree of agreement and tenuousness to it. Therefore, one has to be very careful about it. It's one of those relationships that you have to work on constantly. And I say to a married couple, and they're officiated away, I say, one thing I want to tell you about, I don't know how hard you're working in your jobs, but this is going to be harder than anything you've ever done before. And if you don't put in the kind of time that you're used to putting into other things, you're going to have a lot of problems. Because this is really a lot of work. Okay? Basic to marriage.
I confabulated the belief that
confabulated. I like that word.
I've made up in my mind that maybe the older rabbis who had daughters were very concerned about protecting their daughters as wives, mm-hmm. and that's why there's so many protections.
I see. It'd be interesting to see whether you can actually check that out and see these names and see if we know who their children are. It'd be an interesting piece of research to do. In general, I'm sure you're white. And you're right. In general, I'm sure you're right. Fathers are concerned about their daughters. And if there's anything you want to see in a son-in-law, is somebody who's going to treat your daughter properly.
And you want to put them on notice.
Yeah. If you have that option. Amar Rav Chisda. Rav Chisda said, Kol Asharim Min Alim Hutz Mishare Ona'a. Now it goes beyond that. Look at this. All of the gates are locked. And we just learned that one gate is open. That's the gate of tears. I have another point of view. It says all of the gates are locked, with one exception. Chutz Mishare Ona'a. Right? With the exception of the gate of making people feel bad. Back to where we started. Back to where we were. Shenemar, as it says, Hine Adonai Nitzav Al Chomat Anach Uviyado Anach. It stated, and behold, God stood upon the wall. This is in the book of Amos. God stands Al Chomat, and in the book of Anach is a plumb line. Anach is a plumb line. But again, one of the beauties of Hebrew is it's a plumb line, but it's not a plumb line. Anach is like Ona'a Shalcha. It's a contraction of two words. Your Ona'a is Anach. Your Ona'a. So in other words, when you make somebody feel bad, that's God's concern. Okay? Anach, God's concern. Hine Adonai Nitzav, the Lord is standing Al Chomat Anach, on the wall of your Ona'a. Uviyado. What? The rabbis, they see that, but they also see a contraction of two words, Ona'a and Shalcha. Right? Right? And Uviyado. And in his hand, whose hand? God's hand. Anach is an Anach. Anach means the same thing again, not just a plumb line. In the book of Amos, we know it means plumb line. That doesn't matter, it means the rabbis have to interpret it that way. Right? It means that there's a moral plumb line, that God has created the world with certain straight lines in it. And a people that does wrong is trying to create crooked lines. Right? In the world that God has created, there is a straight line called the plumb line. And the building should be straight that you create with your life. You have to use the divine plumb line. But here, the your Anach, the latter, the second one, refers to God. That Ona'a Shalcha, your wronging someone else, is God's concern as well. Okay, so that is the significance of Amar Rabbi Elazar, Hakol Nifra B'yedei Shaliach. Everything is punished through can be punished through an intermediary, Chutz Me'ona'a, with the exception of hurting somebody. Shene'amar Uviyado Anach, as it says, in his hand is the Anach, namely, is Ona'a Shalcha, is your wrongdoing making another person feel bad. In God's hand. Amar Rabbi Abahu, Gimel Ein HaParagod Min Al Bifneihem. There are three things that the curtain is not covered before. Now, this is an image that you have occasionally in the Talmud, that God is behind a curtain. And that God is hidden from everything by a curtain. And me'acharei ha'paragot is behind the curtain. In other words, if you have insight into God's own life, you are seeing beyond the curtain. So the curtain, in other words, a lot of things bounce off the curtain. Sometimes the curtain's open, sometimes the curtain is closed. But most things don't get through the curtain. There are a few things that always get through that curtain. In other words, that have a direct line to God. What are they? You can figure it out. Ona'a. What gets to God? Ona'a. And Ona'a being, it doesn't say which Ona'a here, whether we're talking about the Ona'a of sales. I think it's referring to the Ona'a of Devarim, hurting a person with words. The Gezel. Gezel is robbery. The Avodah Zarah and idolatry. The scriptural source is that same source in the book of Amos. Uviyado anach. In his hand is anach, ona'a shalcha. Gezel dichtiv chamas v'shod yishama ba al panai tamid. Robbery and plundering shall be heard before me always, tamid. So in other words, can get beyond the curtain. The people who anger me before me always. Always. In other words, always can go right beyond the curtain. Okay, now the next comment is related to what we had read just before. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, Li'olam yehe adam zahir bitavua betoch beto. A man should always be very careful with the wheat that is in his house. She'en meriva mitzuya betoch beito. Oops. Let me put a chair up. Let me get up kind of quickly. Okay. So a person should always be concerned about the grain that is in his household. Why? She'en meriva mitzuya betoch beito shel adam ela al iske tivua. There is nothing that causes strife within a household like the lack of grain. Very profound thought. And I see it now. In economic time, when there are troubles, economic problems, husbands and wives have problems. There is tension in the household. Frequently, where there is monetary tension, where people feel monetary pressure, frequently that's reflected in the relation between a husband and a wife. So here, this is saying, you know, that one has to remove that in order to be sure that quarrels are not frequent in a household. Amar Rav Papa, as Rav Papa says, Hainu da amre inche, as people say, Kimishlam sare mikada, when the barley in the container is gone, Nakish va'ate tigre beveta, quarrel begins to bang around in a house. Alright? In other words, in hard times, the stress is felt between the husband and wife as well. Va'amar Ravchinana Bar Papa, Ravchinana Bar Papa says, Li'olam yehe adam zehir bitfua betoch beto. Person should always be careful with the grain that is in his house. Shalom nikra'u Yisrael dalim, for the Jewish people were called poor, ela al iskeit vuah, on account of the scarcity of grain. Shne'amar v'haya im zara Yisrael, for it is stated that Israel, when Israel had sown, uchtiv v'yachanu aleihem, and the Midianites encamped against them, uchtiv v'yidal Yisrael ma'od mipnei Midian, Israel was greatly impoverished because of Midian. The Amar Rabbi Chelbo says, Li'olam yehe adam zehir b'chvod ishto. A man should always be concerned about his wife's honor. That means honor in the greatest sense of the term, her well-being, that she be respected, to respect one's wife. She'en bracha mitzuya betoch beito shel adam ela bishvilito. For a man's household is filled with blessing only on account of his wife. Only on account of his wife.
I will not quote you.
It's a Talmud, not me. Shenemar, Uli Avram Heitiv Ba'avura. A great statement. It's a great statement of the Torah. That God did well with Abraham Ba'avura because of her, namely his wife Sarah. Right? So in other words, the good that came to Abraham was because of his wife. Ikuru l'nashaychu ki hechi de'ita tru. Oh, now the hainu the amr lahu Rava divnei mechoza. Rava, who was then the teacher, the head of the yeshiva mechoza, said to his students, Okiru l'nashaychu, value your wives, respect your wives, ki hechi de'ita tru, because that will be the source of your wealth. In other words, as it came to Abraham, it will come to you, but only if you are nice to your wives. So it's just fascinating to see that all of this discussion now has sort of moved down into the relation toward one's wife. So it's something that was general. These are, of course, not any things that, in fact, you adjudicate in a bet din. But these are the teachings of in those private parts of a life where the Bet Din doesn't go in. Then one has to act with the highest levels of respect and moral standing. Okay? And be especially sensitive then to the damage that can come from one's words. Comments? Very good, ladies and gentlemen. We will continue next time. Next time we will spend the entire session on the Tanur of Achnai, on the Oven of Achnai, which, as I said to you, if you remember last time, is one of the great stories of the Talmud. And I shall try to prove to you that the only way to understand the story of Achnai is to read it in the context of the brothers Karamazov. And if you could prepare the Grand Inquisitor section of the Brothers Karamazov, we will be referring to that next week.